One of the most important quality of life innovations in prostate cancer management has been the evolving role of intermittent androgen deprivation. I met with Dr. Nicholas Vogelsang to discuss this subject and related issues in systemic management of the disease. Dr. Vogelsang began our conversation by reviewing what we currently understand about intermittent androgen deprivation.
The SWOG trial of intermittent versus continuous hormone therapy is a very good trial. I don't know how long it will take to get the answer, but it's clearly continuing to be a burning question. The trial from Portugal, reported at ASCO this past year, suggested that they were equivalent in the abstract, but then when we heard him talk, he all of a sudden said in a throwaway sentence, but in overt metastatic disease, intermittent hormone therapy was inferior. And we all sort of went, what? So yeah, intermittent hormone therapy might be fine in the PSA-only relapses, but it's not okay, or it doesn't appear to be okay in the metastatic setting. Therefore, the SWOG trial is still very relevant.
Can you talk about the design of that study and what the background is in terms of other studies that have looked at that issue?
Well, the study is a very large trial designed in the late 90s, and it has some significant methodologic flaws. It allows men to get 7 cycles or 8 months of hormone therapy for overt metastatic disease. Then patients are randomized to intermittent hormone therapy or continuous hormone therapy. If their PSAs have not dropped below 4, they are not allowed to be randomized. And Maha Hussein's abstract at ASCO this past June gave us very striking preliminary data showing that we set the point at 4, and that proved to be very smart, because if they never got below 4, they have a survival of less than 18 months. If they get below 4 but still detectable, their survival is about 3 years. And if they get below undetectable or undetectable and below, they have a survival that's nearly 75 or 80 months. So that's a remarkable post-treatment prognostic factor. And I think that that will probably dominate the results. I don't know if intermittent versus continuous will improve upon those 3 major categories. First of all, if your PSA is 4 or more after the first 8 months of therapy, you're probably going to do badly whether you're intermittent or continuous. And if you're below 0.1 or less than detectable, you're probably going to do great whether you can do intermittent or continuous. So in that subset, the intermittent might win. Again, the other problem with the study is that it doesn't define testosterone recovery precisely. So we don't really know how long it takes testosterone to recover after the first 8 months, and it's a function of age. The older men have slower and longer times to recover. So I think there's going to be a lot of unanswered questions.
Now, this trial is for metastatic disease, correct?
It's for metastatic disease, right. But it could be nodal metastases as long as there's something measurable.
But this is the first time they've received endocrine therapy for metastatic disease.
That's correct. And it does require combination androgen blockade. So it requires both Casodex and Zoladex. The drugs are supplied free. It's a very attractive study for patients diagnosed with metastatic disease.
Have you put patients on the study yourself?
Oh, yeah, over 40. So I know the study pretty well.
What's your own experience in terms of quality of life with these men when they do come off therapy?
It's very interesting. For the men who I would like to get off therapy, those men who are gaining weight, having a lot of hot flashes, they seem to always get randomized to continue study. And the men who are tolerating it well and with not a lot of weight gain, not a lot of hot flashing, they get intermittent hormone therapy. But in general, I think the continuous hormone therapy is likely to show a negative quality of life because of the weight gain, because of the hot flashing. And we'll see. It's a huge study. You could also randomly assign men to the Zometa trial, and that's either Zometa every 3 months or placebo every 3 months. That trial is powered to have a skeletal-related event endpoint. That is Matt Smith's trial as a CLGB companion, if you will, to the SWOG trial. It's a good study, accruing fairly well, and will give us an answer about Zometa at the time of hormone therapy, which it is not currently approved for.
What's the usual typical clinical history of a man who has metastatic disease and has never had hormones?
Well, they're usually fairly healthy individuals who just have not been screened. For example, one I just saw the other day was a PhD from one of the big industries out east who never got a PSA. He walked in with some back pain. His PSA was 198, and he had metastatic bone disease. He was randomized as doing great. His PSA has become undetectable. And unfortunately, he was randomized to continuous, and he's gained a lot of weight. He's just retired. He's 65. The metastatic presentation has traditionally been dropping. So it was, when I first was a resident fellow, it was 40%. It is now down to less than 10%. It probably is a function of socioeconomic status. On the south side of Chicago, where I used to be, we had substantial numbers of men who would still come in with metastatic disease. And here in Las Vegas, where there are some economic barriers to screening and not a refined screening system, we see plenty of patients. I mean, I think we've entered, since I've been open in the last 18 months, we've probably had a dozen men enter the study, plus another 5 to 10 men who've refused the study for some reasons.
Now, you mentioned that this study uses combined androgen blockade with a bicalutamide. What's your practice in general in terms of using maximal androgen blockade in general in a non-protocol setting?
I still continue to use bicalutamide. I've looked at this many different times in many different ways. The meta-analysis shows that flutamide and nilutamide added to LHRH agonist therapy does have a small but statistically significant improvement in survival. If you look at cipriterone acetate, a megestrol acetate derivative added to Lupron or orchiectomy or LHRH agonist or orchiectomy, you get a decrement in survival. So the estrogenic or progestational agents have a negative effect, and they're not to be combined with LHRH agonists. Bicalutamide has been studied in only one trial, a Japanese trial in which bicalutamide was given at a dose of 80 milligrams, the Japanese dose. And that showed a remarkable improvement for the bicalutamide added to the LHRH agonist. That's the only study available of LHRH with or without bicalutamide. There are indirect studies. For example, the big Shellhammer study randomized patients to flutamide and leuprolide versus Casodex and Gucerolin, and there was a 2x2 factorial design. The bicalutamide arm was superior to the flutamide arm, and in turn, that arm was superior to single-agent Gucerolin. So that's an indirect study suggesting, again, that bicalutamide has an advantage. So I continue to prescribe long-term bicalutamide. It does have a decreased quality of life. The hot flashing appears to be worse. The cost is a significant variable. But nonetheless, it's comparable to the benefit of adjuvant tamoxifen in breast cancer. Therefore, I continue to use bicalutamide in my patients.
What we've seen in our patterns of care studies and also in talking to clinical investigators is that's by far not necessarily what's done in practice. A lot of people don't even discuss it as an option with patients because they're concerned about cost.
It's true that I've become the minority. And I appreciate the fact that perhaps people have read guidelines. The guidelines were written based upon the flutamide and nilutamide data showing not much of an advantage, and people didn't read the fine print. If they'd looked at the fine print, they would have seen that the slight benefit of flutamide and nilutamide, which is about 3 to 4% survival difference at 5 years, is counterbalanced by the cipriterone acetate data, and that bicalutamide wasn't in there. So I continue to be a bit of a contrarian and continue to prescribe bicalutamide. I can't help what the ASCO guidelines say. I couldn't get them to be rewritten. Or the AUA guidelines, for that matter.
Let's talk a little bit more about metastatic disease and sort of carrying forth with the same type of patient population. How do you approach that situation once they've progressed beyond first line, in your case, MAB?
What I do then is use a variety of secondary maneuvers. However, what I like to do is explain to them that these secondary maneuvers are probably all roughly equivalent, whether you add bicalutamide or add nilutamide or add flutamide, or whether you add ketoconazole or add estrogens or subtract estrogens. They all seem to be about the same. Beneficial rates are between 10 and 40%. And I do believe patients live longer when you give secondary hormone therapy, be it the antiandrogens, ketoconazole, DES. I also strongly encourage people to enter clinical trials, and the Dendreon trial is one that I'm particularly fascinated by. Eric Small's data, published about a year ago, showed that randomization in two small trials to either the Dendreon vaccine or placebo showed a survival advantage for the vaccine. Those two studies have been criticized for being underpowered, et cetera, et cetera. But when you look at them very carefully, I can't help but conclude that there seems to be a real positive biologic effect. So I encourage randomization into that trial. That trial is still open.
Can you explain what that substance is?
It's not truly a vaccine. It's a fusion protein. The patients are pheresed. They undergo leukapheresis. Their white cells are then transferred to a series of manufacturing or processing facilities around the country. And the white cells are then exposed to a fusion protein which contains prostatic acid phosphatase linked to GM-CSF. That converts the population within the white cells that are dendritic cells to activated dendritic cells. You then reinfuse them to the patients in a 2-to-1 randomized fashion. 2 out of every 3 patients get the activated cells. 1 out of every 3 get the inactivated cells. Those 1/3 of patients can get the activated cells later.
What are the dendritic cells?
The dendritic cells are a subpopulation of blood-borne monocytes and macrophages. They're not all monocytes or macrophages, but they're a subpopulation. And they are the antigen-presenting cells. They take up the prostatic acid phosphatase antigen, display it to T cells, and T cells then become reactive to prostatic acid phosphatase, which is found ubiquitously on prostate cancer cells. That technology can be applied to any number of other antigens, and in fact, the company is looking at other antigens for breast cancer and other such tumors like ovarian cancer.
Have objective responses been seen to this substance?
They have. They're not highly common. Since it's an immunologic approach, the first 3 to 4 months, not much happens because the T cells have to become activated and then have to go on to kill the cells. And this is exactly the same time frame that we saw for autologous transplant for solid tumor, breast cancer, and renal cell. It takes about 4 to 6 months to get patients immunologically responsive. And then once they get to that point, there are responses, but not high numbers. It truly appears to be a static effect of an immunologic agent.
What about side effects and toxicity?
There's 3 infusions, week 0, week 2, and week 4. They get chills, they get fever occasionally, a little Tylenol. The biggest problem is that progressive bone pain. I mean, they're still needing to be treated for their bone pain. The study doesn't allow them to have bone pain going into the study. But if they get bone pain, you then have to unblind them and give them chemotherapy. It's a relatively easy randomization, and I don't know how the accrual is going nationally, but I think it's going pretty well.
Let's talk a little bit more about sort of the next part of your algorithm for metastatic disease.
The ECOG has got a very nice trial of moving docetaxel earlier into hormone-sensitive. That's called the CHARTED study. They're taking patients with poorer risk, higher PSAs, higher alkaline phosphatases with bone pain, and randomizing them to hormones versus hormones with chemotherapy, in this case, docetaxel. That trial is underway. It's a well-designed trial. The difficulty there is that there have been at least 3, if not more, trials looking at hormones with or without chemotherapy in the past. And in contrast to breast cancer, where chemo and hormones are routinely given together, those trials in prostate cancer have not shown an advantage to the chemotherapy. Now, granted, it was old-line chemotherapy. It was CMF. It was not necessarily docetaxel or taxane-based. So there is a reasonable chance that CHARTED study will show an improvement in survival with the addition of docetaxel at the hormone-sensitive phase rather than at the hormone-resistant phase.
Are there any situations outside of a protocol setting where you might start chemotherapy when hormone therapy is being initiated?
Well, I have a number of friends who do use docetaxel at the time of hormone-sensitive metastatic disease. We argue about this, and I explain to them that there is no evidence, but they point to me to data suggesting that in every model system, when you have an active agent, you should move it up earlier. And so we have an ongoing agreement to disagree, if you will. I use docetaxel not in the frank metastatic setting, but in the setting where patients have overtly poor risk disease. PSA failure to normalize after radical prostatectomy, for example, is a classic situation. There's no trials there. Patients commonly will have node metastases, seminal vesicle involvement, or positive margins. You'll say, okay, we got to give you adjuvant radiation therapy. And for particularly young people, what I've recommended in maybe a handful of patients is docetaxel with hormone therapy at that point. Now, Mary Ellen Taplin and the group at Harvard just reported their study of 15 months of hormone therapy combined with docetaxel for that population of patients, or the population that had a rising PSA after radiation. The results were not all that stunning. There were 33% of patients at 3 years who had not had a rise of PSA, but the remaining 60 to 70% had already experienced a rise of PSA, and that was after only 15 months of hormone therapy and docetaxel. The RTOG has a very large trial for poor risk disease of IMRT with definitive local therapy, hormone therapy, I believe it's for 2 years, with or without docetaxel. And Sanofi also has a trial for patients after radical prostatectomy of a docetaxel and hormones randomized trial. That's run by Mario Eisenberger, and it's a 2x2 factorial. Patients will be randomized after surgery and undetectable PSA to either get immediate adjuvant hormones, immediate adjuvant hormones and chemo versus delayed hormones or delayed hormones and chemo. A little complicated. Patients are not allowed to get radiation adjuvantly, which eliminates some of those patients who probably should get immediate radiation. Radiation is allowed only after hormones and chemo and only when the PSA hits 0.4. But it's a doable study, and patients are randomizing, and it's going along.
What about the use of chemotherapy, specifically docetaxel, in patients with PSA-only disease? In which situations in a non-protocol setting will you consider it, and what trials are going on right now looking at that?
Well, it's rare. Unfortunately, there's not enough trials. The one I mentioned of Mary Ellen Taplin is just that, PSA detectable after radical prostatectomy or radiation and rising. It's a challenging field because these patients often will go with hormones instead of chemo. You have to basically give them the option to say, well, do you want hormones or do you want hormones and chemo? And Mary Ellen's study has given a lot of us pause. That at 3 years, only 30% of people are still PSA undetectable is, I would say, not a home run. These patients are still persisting with their PSA. Maybe you're altering the natural history a bit, but I've been reluctant to go with docetaxel for just the rising PSA patients. I think you can get more mileage with hormones, secondary, et cetera.
Let's talk a little bit about docetaxel and metastatic disease. And, you know, it's very difficult, I think, for physicians who are not medical oncologists and actually doing it to get a real feel for what some of these things mean to their patient in terms of the risks and side effects they're exposed to and how much benefit. Can you kind of put at a clinical level in perspective what docetaxel do you think brings to the patient and what are the situations that you've observed with this approach?
Docetaxel has really been a huge beneficial drug for patients who have painful bone metastases from prostate cancer. There is no question this drug benefits a substantial majority of patients, 80 to 85% of patients. And some of these patients have benefit that lasts for 2 years or more. So the urologists and the radiation oncologists should feel comfortable endorsing the drug as a safety net should hormones fail. And that is encouraging to patients. And they would help the medical oncologists if they simply say, look, there is this drug that we will use if hormones do not work. And you shouldn't be afraid of this chemotherapy. It's a natural product. It's derived from tree bark. And it is safe and effective in the majority of patients. So somewhere between that statement and the chemotherapy is awful statement is where most people still fall. They tend to say, well, you know, chemotherapy, sort of lukewarm endorsement. I don't think that endorsement should be lukewarm. This drug can have dramatic clinical benefit in substantial numbers of patients. I have one gentleman who's now going on 2 years of docetaxel. And if I don't give him his docetaxel, his pain roars back. It's only when he's on docetaxel that he has pain control. And within weeks after missing a dose of docetaxel, his PSA rises, his alk phos starts going up, and he has bone pain again. I cannot explain why his tumor continues to be sensitive to docetaxel after this many years, but for some reason, he has not developed resistance to docetaxel. So it's a good drug, should not be feared.
What do you tell a patient to expect in terms of quality of life, or maybe a referring urologist in terms of, you know, sort of what are the day-to-day issues going to be with docetaxel?
Well, if a patient is beginning the docetaxel, let's say for a PSA of 40 or 50, and they have retroperitoneal nodes and maybe a few bone scan lesions, those patients do extremely well. They are not sick. They can work almost every day except for the day of chemo. They get prednisone or Decadron with the docetaxel, so they virtually have no nausea. The biggest problems are nail changes. They get some cracking and curling, and sometimes their nails begin to lift off. They get some tearing. They may get some skin changes, but there's not much leukopenia. There's not much thrombocytopenia. They don't really get particularly anemic. There's no real organ toxicity. I mean, their kidneys don't go bad. The liver is not necessarily affected. It's extremely rare to see a pulmonary complication. So the drug is just simply easy to give.
What schedule do you generally use?
I still continue to use the recommended dose from the SWOG trial, which is every 3 weeks, IV, 70 to 75 milligrams. For the very debilitated elderly patients, I continue to use the weekly regimen. For example, I saw an 82-year-old who was in a wheelchair and had liver metastases and had vowed never to take chemotherapy. And I said, look, what are you going to lose? Let's try the weekly therapy. And his PSA, which was 290, is now down to 20. He's out of the wheelchair, and he doesn't have any of his edema anymore, and his liver function tests have improved. So I've now had to switch him to every 2 to 3 weeks because of the skin and nail changes, but that's really it.
We do patterns of care surveys where we've been asking radiation oncologists and urologists about what their perceptions are of chemotherapy. And they tell us verbally, they seem to be aware of it. They seem to be aware that this is different than what's been seen in the past. But in terms of actual clinical practice, do you have any feel in terms of referrals to oncologists? How many patients end up dying who never see an oncologist, for example?
Well, it's rare, I think. But what the biggest problem is, we still have patients who are so afraid of chemotherapy for whatever reason that they decline. And I'm remarkably surprised that in this day and age, these men are still remembering the history of chemotherapy 10 or 15 years ago.
So you're saying they get to you, but still they don't want to be treated once you discuss it with them.
Yeah, it's rare, maybe one every 2 or 3 months. Many of them have biases for one reason or another, cost, insurance, transportation. I think of all the patients with metastatic disease that I've recently seen, there was only one man who couldn't get docetaxel, and it was an insurance issue. He went back to his local oncologist who gave him ketoconazole, and the patient died of his liver metastases before he could ever get chemo. And I think that's sad because the chemo should have prolonged his life and improved his quality of life.
Can you put in perspective overall what the risk ratio is of docetaxel and metastatic prostate cancer compared to some of the other common tumors that there's been a lot of excitement about, specifically breast cancer, colorectal cancer, you know, even lung cancer, maybe not quite so much. Overall, again, trying to put that in perspective.
The average survival of patients with hormone-sensitive metastatic prostate cancer is about 2 to 3 years. That's the number we still quote. However, once patients get on docetaxel, their median survival is still 18 months. That's as good, if not the same, as breast cancer and colorectal cancer, and better than non-small cell lung cancer. So even once you start chemotherapy, you get a little bit less than 2 years. Some of the trials are approaching 28 months median survival with docetaxel. Colorectal cancer has had a remarkable improvement, of course, with 5-FU era being 9 to 10 months, and now with the multi-drug regimens looking at 24 months and beyond. But prostate cancer has done really well and we should not be negative about chemo.
It's really striking in terms of the lack of data on adjuvant chemotherapy in prostate cancer. Even lung cancer now is quite a bit of data finally on adjuvant therapy, but there's not very much available for prostate.
Well, good question. I know you're probably heard about the SWOG trial of adjuvant mitoxantrone was just closed this past week by the Data Monitoring Safety Board because there was 3 cases of acute leukemia associated with mitoxantrone in the 488 patients randomized to adjuvant mitoxantrone versus those randomized to just pure adjuvant hormone therapy. That's, I think, expected that there was going to be some excess leukemia. The trial was powered to go to about 1,200 patients, so it's about 200 patients short of its accrual goal. Whether there will be sufficient power to show a benefit of adjuvant mitoxantrone remains unclear, but that's why the current trial that Mario Eisenberger is running of adjuvant docetaxel is so important. That trial needs to be supported heavily, and we can get the answer. That's a chemotherapy of docetaxel versus hormones alone. And that will be the second big adjuvant chemotherapy trial done.
So how long has that SWOG trial been up and running now?
Dr. Crawford and the intergroup leaders designed that trial back in 1996, as I recall. By the time it finally saw the light of day, it was 99. But it took, you know, the usual 2 years to get the cooperative group herds to go in one direction.
What do you think about the fact that it was closed and for the reason that it was closed?
Well, mitoxantrone is known to be a topo II inhibitor, and just like adriamycin causes leukemia in breast cancer given an adjuvant setting, so mitoxantrone will cause leukemia in a very small number of patients. 3 out of about 500 is about what has been estimated. That's not an unexpected finding.
It also is accrued really poorly. Closing that study is almost like a hospice move to me.
Well, at some level, I think we put a huge amount of effort into it to get it to stay alive because there was no other choices. But now that docetaxel is available, I think it's still going to be a landmark study. Stay tuned. I mean, remember that one small trial in England of mitoxantrone adjuvant showed a pretty striking survival advantage for mitoxantrone given in an adjuvant setting.
I think it'd be great in terms of motivating people. And as you say, I mean, they have almost the adequate numbers. When do you think we might see some of the efficacy data?
You know, I'm not on the safety monitoring committee. The chairman is Mike Lodey from University of Colorado. I bet you it's going to take another 2 or 3 years. I don't think we're ready to reach the median survival. Remember, all patients get 2 years of adjuvant hormones. And in the messing trial for node-positive prostate cancer, randomized to hormones or nothing, the median survival with hormones was 7 years for node positive versus about 3 years for no treatment for node positive disease. There's been some other studies from EORTC that aren't that strikingly positive for adjuvant hormones, but still we should not expect the adjuvant hormone arm to be that bad as 3 years. I think it'll be better than that.
How many men a year do you think are presenting? I don't know if this has come out in some of the discussions about these studies that would be eligible for these adjuvant trials. What fraction of prostate cancer does that make up?
Almost all of the T3s are eligible. And the percentage of men with T3 disease from the Mayo series and from, I looked, for example, recently at the Memorial series and the Vanderbilt series, probably about 22% of men who undergo radical prostatectomy should be considered for adjuvant therapy. They're the ones that have a predicted survival of below 50% at 10 years.
As long as we're talking about adjuvant therapy, I'm curious what your thoughts are about the EPC study looking at bicalutamide monotherapy.
That trial is disappointing. I think you could argue it many ways. It was given to a better risk group of patients than we expected. It was not pathologic staging in substantial numbers of patients. And there's a detrimental effect of the high dose of bicalutamide compared to the 50 milligram dose. It seems to be an excess risk of cardiovascular disease. So I'm disappointed. I don't know what exactly is the reason for the negative result. There is a trend. The survival curves are beginning to split. Bill C's reporting it now, I think, at 7 years. But there's no overall survival advantage. There's a disease-specific or relapse-free survival advantage, but no overall survival advantage. Prostate cancer is not the same as breast cancer, and early hormone therapy may not have the same impact as tamoxifen or raloxifene does in breast cancer.
Well, also, breast cancer doesn't have PSA, and when I look at the EPSC, it seems like one of the major complicating factors is the fact that so many people get treated so early for PSA progression, and that just makes it much harder to pick up any effect.
That's exactly right. Many of my urology colleagues have said the same thing. If you look at the natural history of breast cancer, there are no markers for early relapse of breast cancer, and therefore you can't give hormone therapy early. Whereas PSA relapse may be only 10% down the path of the natural history of prostate cancer, and 10% early versus 10% a little bit later may not be sufficient to change the natural history of prostate cancer.
Are there any situation where you would recommend adjuvant hormonal therapy for a patient who's had a prostatectomy off study?
I do. I recommend it particularly in those men whose PSAs fail to become undetectable. And if they're not healthy enough for an adjuvant trial or not well enough for chemotherapy. Of course, this failure to normalize after radical prostatectomy, in my opinion, mandates adjuvant radiation therapy as well, although some people will do the Prostacent and argue with me, and I'm sure my urology colleagues or some of them are gritting their teeth saying, I don't use adjuvant radiation. But nonetheless, I believe the data support adjuvant radiotherapy. And for those men, the RTOG trials strongly support adjuvant hormone therapy as well.
The last thing I want to ask you about is the way the medical oncologist and community practice is integrated into the care of prostate cancer patients. Do you think that there might be some value in some way getting the oncologist more involved or involved earlier?
I think there's a definite trend towards integration of the medical oncologist. The urologists have been able, by and large, to do many of these trials themselves. Now, whether that's good or bad remains to be seen. But certainly the adjuvant bicalutamide trial was done completely by urologists. The initial series of Dendrion trials, the GVAX trials, many of those were done by urologists. However, with the current Aventis-sponsored trial of adjuvant docetaxel, that requires careful collaboration between the surgeon, the radiation oncologist, and the medical oncologist. And you need to be talking to each other. And therefore, that will cause integration. There is also a trial underway that I've been talking with the CRO leaders about. And that is at first sign of PSA relapse, be it undetectable to detectable or rising from a nadir of 0.1 or 0.2, to randomize patients to docetaxel then or to later. That would be an interesting trial. Basically, it's taking Mary Ellen Taplin's data and saying, let's prove that the 3-year 33% PSA-free survival can be documented to show a survival advantage. So there is movement afoot across the entire spectrum of prostate cancer to give adjuvant chemotherapy.
This concludes our program. Special thanks to our speakers, and thank you for listening. This is Dr. Neil Love for Prostate Cancer Update.